Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Let's say China. China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
All right, everyone. Welcome to another great episode of Reconsider, part of the Agora Podcast Network, where we don't do the thinking for you. And in classic Reconsider style, I have a bit of a oopsie from the last episode. Not that we oopsie a lot, but confessing it is our thing. So in our last episode about nationalism, it talked about the United States as sort of the glaring exception to ethnicity as nationalism or ethnicity as national identity and saying, yeah, isn't it great, America? And then I forgot, having spent 3 years in our wonderful neighborly northern buddies, Canada, I just forgot to add them to the list. And of course, Canada is another huge example of national identity at not as ethnicity. In fact, Canada is more ethnically diverse than the United States and arguably has fewer like multi-ethnic integration issues historically and currently. So sorry, Canada. I know that's your favorite word. And good work on being, you know, not all about your ethnic identity and having a really cool concept of national identity, which is also very different from the United States concept of national identity, because it's much more, less about like revolution and freedom. It's its own kettle of fish and a really cool place. Love you, Canada. Mwah. And then other thing before we get started is, if you've been listening to Reconsider for a long time, you've heard this us plug Heather's Renaissance English History podcast before, but holy smokes, is it good? Is it fun? She got me into English history for the first time because, you know, as a good red-blooded American, I'm like, ah, England, the oppressors, right? Like they have kings and stuff and they hate freedom. And I decided to listen to her podcast in part because we like went to visit them in Spain. It was pretty cool and we hung out and I learned just how well researched she is and just how smart she is and how fun and funny. So I finally started listening to it for serious about a year ago and it's the best Renaissance English history podcast. It's a great time. Go learn about your tutors.
So with that, we are today kicking off a new series on reconsidering China, sort of like our series on reconsidering Russia, just with less alliteration. So like Russia, China has a troubled relationship with the West, and people often misunderstand the causes of that troubled relationship. So we're going to try to do what we do here at Reconsider, go into some of the history, talk about some of the context, some of their geopolitical interests, and just generally discuss how the country works internally so you can get a better sense for why it's acting the way it is externally. So the first step to going over some of the misconceptions that exist out there in common narratives is just to set some of them up and go at them one by one. So before we do that, I'll just remind everyone, if you're listening to whatever episode this is, 60-something now, and you've gotten something out of the Reconsider podcast, we sure would appreciate a review on iTunes or whatever podcast catcher you happen to use. Helps us get out to more people. And yeah, that'd be swell.
We do read them. We take them always as, you know, real good feedback. And, you know, a couple trickle in every week. So it's a nice Sunday afternoon treat for us. So thank you to everyone who has left them. Now on to China. China, of course, so hot right now. And why is that? Well, first, Xi Jinping has set himself up as probably the most powerful leader in China since maybe Mao or Deng Xiaoping. The guy has tons of control over the state. And we've talked actually a little bit about this in some previous episodes, so we won't go too deeply into it. But Xi is running the show with a iron fist and a velvet glove. And, you know, there's something maybe strangely attractive about it. You know, you can sort of say like, well, at least their system is coherent. And, you know, the US or the West are like kind of falling apart, and there's internal divisions ripping apart Europe, ripping apart the United States. And China seems to be, you know, marching in lockstep, which, you know, I'll have an aside. That's what people said about Italy and Germany in the early 1930s. Just saying. But China has not devolved into becoming, you know, after 60 years of communism, has not devolved into trying to, you know, take over all of the continent and murder everyone. So good on you, China. And their like form of centralized capitalism, where you have a capitalist system that's like guided and run by the state to a large extent, like seems to be working pretty well. You know, the growth rate is good. It doesn't go through recessions the way that Western economies do. Maybe there's something to it. And of course, now we have a trade war, and apparently it's going to be easy and we're going to win. Apparently China doesn't think so. And we're all terrifying each other now. So that's exciting. And then, of course, as always, there's North Korea and China's weird relationship with North Korea and the United States and basically all of its neighbors that the United States cares about. Strange relationships, kind of frenemies is a common word. It's a weird, weird place with respect to how we normally think about a Western country's relationship with another country. And so there's a lot to unpack.
I'll use this as an opportunity to get to know your host a little bit better. Throughout this episode, you'll hear Eric pronouncing Chinese names with much greater finesse and accuracy than I can. And that's because Eric actually speaks a little bit of Mandarin.
Yo, yi xue.
I assume that means yes, totally.
It means a little bit. Yo, yi xue. And yeah, I studied Chinese for 8 years. I actually got my minor in Chinese East Asian Studies at MIT. I worked for Professor M. Taylor Fravel for a while on his book, which I'm actually going to be citing a lot in this, and I spent 4 months in China. So I actually, it's hard not to like tell you what I think about China, but I do have like a lot of kind of insider information, at least, you know, for your average run-of-the-mill like white dude living in East Coast United States. So yes, you know, those pronunciations will be not bad.
So digging into the meat, what are some of the misconceptions about China? And some of these will be less complete misconceptions than just a narrative that's not always fully fleshed out. So just that caveat. One that comes up a lot is this idea that China is becoming this massive power and could therefore, in some amount of time, just completely beat the U.S. in a war. And right now, that it just depends on what you mean by war, right? As far as military capability and technology, right now the U.S. is still completely unrivaled, even by China. China is gradually beginning to build some aircraft carriers, although they don't really have the deep operating experience in order to run sort of a fleet from the water as the U.S. does. Presumably over time, that'll change a little bit. But then, of course, there's the question of whether or not aircraft carriers are even going to be like a really powerful weapon system in 20 years because of, you know, precision-guided missiles and all that stuff. But aside from that, the point is the U.S. is still further ahead, spends a lot more money on technology and defense every year, and has generally had a more active military than China has over the last 4 decades or so, at least since 1979, right, which is when they went to war with Vietnam. That said, as General Douglas MacArthur said back in the day, you know, don't get into a land war on mainland Asia. And that's because the U.S. just doesn't have enough people to actually go to, say, China and permanently occupy the country. So when you talk about wars, quote unquote wars, and who can quote unquote win them, you kind of have to think about what winning means. And I think that's something that's lost in this narrative a lot. You know, would the U.S. have to occupy China in order to win a war, because if so, that'd be very difficult. We've seen that the U.S. generally doesn't have popular will to occupy large territories unless it's like a major total war. And even then, like, Japan is much smaller than China.
Not been a good track record lately, guys. Not been a good track record.
Yeah, for reals. But if the war is just we need to basically blockade China in collaboration with our allies in the Pacific Rim, that's a different story, because that is something that the U.S. has the capability to do, and it wouldn't take as much direct conflict, probably.
Yeah, I'm actually, quick digression, just the idea of aircraft carriers being obsolete in 20 years is at once horrifying and also very exciting. And I actually remember reading George Freeman's The Next 100 Years, which I believe was released in 2000 or just about, or maybe just after 9/11. But as he like imagined or sort of projected out like technological advancements over the next 100 years, one of the things he talked about was, look, really small hypersonic guided missiles that can like duck, dodge, dive, and dodge can. Sorry, I was trying to quote Dodgeball there. Dodge, duck, dive, dip, and dodge. There we go. The five Ds. But, you know, hypersonic missiles that can do that will just be like, oh, cute. Someone's sending an aircraft carrier my way. I'm 3,000 miles away. Fire a missile. Okay, it's gone. Great. And I think like the most absurd form of the China could beat the United States thing is like, well, they have 1.4 billion people and they could just send them all in boats. It's like, yeah, but the Pacific Ocean is very, 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 very big. It's in fact the biggest thing on Earth. Period. And those boats ain't going to make it over to the other side. So, yeah, I mean, if at the end of the day, if the United States like got into a conflict with China over, say, the South China Sea, which probably would be the most likely place for a conflict anytime soon, even more likely than Taiwan, which we'll get to in a second. You know, if it was about the United States exerting free access to the sea in the South China Sea versus China, like China would not fare well. It just doesn't have the Blue Water Navy or Air Force capable of doing that. So long story short, U.S. far superior Air Force and Navy, and we'll have that for the foreseeable future, which means if it comes down to military conflict, you know, the United States could probably bottle up China on its own borders.
And if you're interested in reading that book, The Next 100 Years, it's actually published in 2009, a little bit more recent than that, but definitely check it out. You know, blatant pitch for George Friedman's my boss. So, you know, fully transparent there. It's still a good read. Next 100 years, check it out.
And for me, it's a very genuine pitch. I read that book before I even knew who George Freeman was. I got it as like a graduation gift, and it was just really good.
So long story short on the China could beat the U.S. in a war narrative is it's complicated, but the U.S. currently has a far superior Air Force and Navy, a more experienced military. And that means that if it did come down to a military conflict, the U.S. could blockade China, most likely. That is, unless China is able to split off U.S. allies from the alliance structure, but that's sort of something we'll come to in a little bit.
Whew. All right. Another common misconception, and we have already talked about this, so we'll keep it very short, is China owns most of the United States debt and therefore has a lot of power over the United States and can manipulate in some way. Just not true. I know we don't tell you what to think, but this one's just a fact. Like, it owns less than 5% of U.S. debt total. It's just, you know, it would be a headache if China was like, yeah, we're just going to sell all of our debt or not renew it. And it would also be terrible for China's economy. And it's one of those, like, you know, cut off your nose to spite your face sort of dealios. And therefore, like, that power is just very fundamentally limited. If you need to get a refresher on that, go to the national debt episode from, I think, 2 episodes ago.
Yeah, we talked about it in depth. What a strange expression. Cut off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah.
I'm glad I don't live in a time when those sorts of expressions were more commonplace.
Yeah, I'm the only person I'm thinking of is Van Gogh, although it was his ear. And now, of course, I'm thinking about Tyrion Lannister, who lost his nose in the Battle of Blackwater. But of course, in the show, it just becomes a super cool scar, you know, makes Peter Dinklage like even more handsome and rugged and manly. And it's just not fair. Like, he's supposed to be ugly now, and he's not. He's just too hot for to be a true Tyrion Lannister. But anyway, digression over. So
wait, no, it's not. I have okay. to digress a little okay. bit further. Sorry, you'll have to forgive me. This is all going to tie together, you see. Just follow me for 30 seconds. Do you know what Game of Thrones is based off of in a general sense?
Is it the York and Lancaster Civil War in England? War of the Roses. That's what it is. Yeah.
The War of the Roses, 15th century, which, if you want to learn a little bit more about that, again, check out the podcast of the month, Renaissance English History Podcast by Heather Tesco. I don't know which episode this is on, but what got Game of Thrones sparked. It's good.
Bonus points if you figure out who in Game of Thrones is Richard II. Answers in a postcard, please. Top prize is a name recognition on the next episode.
All right. What's our next point, Eric?
China is expansionist and wants to take over Asia. So even if China does not have its ambitions on sending a fleet of fishing vessels to the United States to invade California, my God, they're going to invade everyone else. You know, Korea, Taiwan. Again, we'll get to Taiwan, Japan, Vietnam, whatever. And or what's led to this? Well, to some extent, China, you know, territorial occupation of, say, Xinjiang in the northwest and Tibet in the southwest is something that is not really contended in any serious legal way, but certainly contended in a moral way, where China goes, oh, no, these have always been a part of China, always and forever, always. And people go like, well, like, no, not really. Like, Tibet's and Xinjiang were like pretty independent for a long time. And didn't they kick your butt in a few wars? And China goes, well, it was a really long time ago. They're ours now. And they don't really want to be part of China. And so there is this, like, you know, sense of kind of the expansionist period of, or a seemingly expansionist period of China right after the Civil War, when China was like locking down its borders. And this is a place in particular where Taylor Fravel's book, was it Strong Borders, Secure Nation, is able to tell a lot more about this phenomenon and what China is specifically looking for. But here's the short version. So one, China hasn't made any claims on territory of, you know, like Vietnam or India or et cetera, that it hadn't made in the 1950s. So after the communists took over China, they kind of said, look, based on, you know, this like convoluted historical argument, these are our borders. They're here and that's it. And actually, it did include territory in the South China Sea, even back in the 50s and 60s. Again, see Taylor Fravel's book on this. I actually contributed to some of the research specifically on South China Sea island claims in the 1960s and 70s as a summer internship. So there we go. I was like reading English versions of the People's Daily and all sorts of stuff. It was pretty cool. And like helping make a map. So there's like a little map in there. And that was like kind of my thing. But so long story short is that as far as territory in East Asia, China has been very consistent since the 50s about what it claims. It's had a hard line. And we'll talk about China's history in another episode. But one of the part of the thesis of Fravel's book is that for China, the idea of giving an inch anywhere is like anathema, because it's a very legalist style system. And if you know Chinese history, you know, there's like legalism versus Confucianism. China right now is very legalist, not very Confucianist. And so for them, like, look, we of course we have to stay firm on our borders because we're making the claim that they're immutable and nobody can touch our borders. And if they do, if they get anywhere close, we are just going to freak out and go after them. And this is the this is what caused the war between China and India in the 1960s. So there's a strong case to be made that China actually has an incentive not to make claims outside of what it's made claims about for the past 60 years, because it is so kind of paranoid about people encroaching on it that it's not going to change those territorial claims. But what about kind of hegemony over East Asia, even if it doesn't want to take it over? So the United States obviously is like the preeminent force in East Asia beyond China's like immediate territorial waters, right? Japan essentially outsources its defense to the United States. South Korea, while it wants to have a good relationship with both the US and China, guess what? It's American troops and not Chinese troops in South Korea. Vietnam, despite the fact that the United States, you know, kind of waged a brutal war in Vietnam for over a decade, loves the United States and sees the United States as a critical partner to challenging China. And then Taiwan, again, I promise we'll get to it. Taiwan also has a number of times allowed the United States to roll in a couple of aircraft carriers just to remind China that, like, maybe you shouldn't send troops after Taiwan. And so China knows that right now the United States is too powerful to completely topple its role in East Asia, much less, you know, the international system. You know, the United States, even in the global financial system, has a lot of power in how it built the World Bank, the IMF, etc. What does China want? Well, China wants greater access to foreign markets because it's a very export-driven economy, and it wants to force these like Western-built and Western-backed financial institutions to compete with those of its own. And China's own pursue distinct interests like that are very different from the ones that the Western financial institutions do. So, for example, instead of making funding contingent on a spat of liberalizing government reforms, China's financial institutions don't tie economic deals to political status. And the West critiques them for this. Many African countries don't, and some do. Point is, it just works differently.
Yeah, so China does have some desires to be more globally powerful, to influence multilateral institutions to a greater degree, and basically just to get what it wants more often. But that doesn't mean that China thinks it has the ability to basically topple the U.S. as a power, right? That said, China does want to drive a wedge between the U.S. and some of its Pacific allies. The geographic threat to China that is posed to it by the Pacific Rim countries on China's eastern coast is fairly substantial because they could band together in collaboration with the United States to blockade China, either to prevent imports such as oil or other precious commodities or inputs to manufactured goods that it needs, or exports that, you know, it doesn't depend on exports like it did 10 years ago, but it's still something like 20% of China's GDP is still exports. So that could pose a real problem to China. And the geography, again, makes that fairly easy to do because there is, if you look at a map, a string of islands basically from the southern tip of Japan all the way down around to Singapore and the Malacca Straits, which is where a very small passage through which a lot of trade travels, and that makes that, you know, particularly easy to blockade as well. So if China can peel away those Pacific Rim allies from the U.S., then potentially it can gain better control of its economic lifeline, access to its eastern Pacific coast. And how could it do that? Well, potentially, if China can show all of its Pacific neighbors that U.S. security guarantees are basically useless, and I'm not saying U.S. security guarantees are useless, I'm saying if this is something that China can demonstrate in a way that's successful, then that might make Vietnam or Singapore or the Philippines kind of reconsider their alliances. Now, China has been trying to do this mainly with money so far. And Philippines is a great example because if it can turn Philippines, then that's a whole area that it can begin shipping through to get to the Pacific Ocean, which begins to matter. But the Philippines is the head of the country, Duterte, has been going out and saying nasty things about the U.S. back and forth, back and forth. China's great. We're going to do all this stuff. Ultimately, at the end of the day, when Philippines province of Mindanao was threatened by ISIS, the Philippines went to the U.S. for security support because they didn't want Chinese troops on their soil. And despite a disagreement over this little island off of the western coast of the Philippines, Scarborough Shoal, in which China supposedly claimed like not to encroach too much, they basically have, and the Philippines has been like, what the hell, guys? Like, we told you, but, you know, we realized that there's nothing we can do about it. So right now, even with Duterte's sort of back and forth and criticizing and demonizing the U.S., still heavily dependent on the U.S. for security support.
Yep. In the words of Barack Obama, in response to the Russians who were claiming that the United States were expansionist because of all the bases we had in the world, he said, when there's something strange in your neighborhood, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters. That's not actually his quote, but he did say, like, you know, when shit goes down, who does the world call, right? It's not Russia, it's the United States. And that's how East Asia has been going. And this is a threat for China, not just because of the potential economic, you know, stranglehold that U.S. allies could put on China, but, and we're going to go into the history of the modern history of China, thank goodness only that, because there's a whole podcast for that, and we'll be bringing him in to help us with this part. It's Chris Stewart. He's great. Go listen to a History of China podcast. But when we talk about the modern history of China, when China has been dominated by other countries, brutally, I may add, it's always come from the sea, right? It's never come from the west, from the north. It's always come from the sea in the east. And so China looks just like Russia looks at this like ring of NATO countries from like Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, down to Poland and Bulgaria, going like, wow, that's like a ring of enemies who explicitly have a treaty about us being their enemy. China looks at South Korea, Japan, kind of Taiwan, the Philippines, and even to some extent Vietnam, going like, wow, there's this ring of countries that are like American security dependents and allies that, you know, that have tons of American Air Force and military bases and naval bases that allow the United States, if it wanted to just kind of come kicking our door down. It's a scary look. And so, of course, China has aims to weaken that alliance and weaken the presence of the United States in East Asia, so close to China's front door.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
That's true, except for the Mongols, right?
Oh, yeah.
The Mongols invaded China Mongolia is not going to invade China anytime soon.
Good point. Mongolia is an exception. And to be fair, like if we look at Tibet, if you look at like very old Chinese history, there are invasions from Tibet, but Tibet's now part of China. And a lot of the invasions from Mongolia, actually most of the places that used to invade China, so like Xinjiang, Tibet, Inner Mongolia, southern, like very southern China, all those places are now just part of China. So China has like done a pretty good job of going like, oh yeah, you invaded us. So like now you're part of China now, right? Everyone's like, oh yeah, sure. Sounds good. Except for the Tibetans and the Xinjiangs. But like the Mongolians that invaded, like they just became Chinese. It's like, okay, cool. And the part of Mongolia was left. Yeah. Became like pretty weak.
Yeah. Wasn't there like a whole division within like Kublai Khan's Khanate that asserted that he was getting too Chinese-ized or whatever the...
Sinicized.
Yeah. But anyways, this is not a show on the Mongols, which maybe we should do at some point. I don't know.
I don't know
enough about the history of Mongolia. Anyways, back to China. Does China want to take the U.S. down then? I mean, this is a narrative that exists out there, right? Again, China would like more flexibility in how it conducts its foreign policy. It feels constrained, and it has been constrained to varying degrees over the last 180 years, basically since the Opium Wars. But right now, at least, China still depends heavily on the U.S. as an export market. Not exclusively, but in large part. So it all comes back to that cutting your nose off expression, right? Cut your nose to spite your face. It would be really difficult for China to do something that actually severely crippled the U.S. economy right now, because then it would also cripple the Chinese economy.
Well, there we go. So I know we promised repeatedly to talk about Taiwan. Let's talk about Taiwan. So misconception number X, China wants to take over Taiwan. The answer to this one is actually yes and no. The reason it's definitely no is that if you go to China, you'll hear people just say like Taiwan is part of China. And if you go to Taiwan, most people in Taiwan will say Taiwan is part of China. And this is actually surprising for a lot of Westerners. So let's talk about what Taiwan is and isn't and talk about the history. So Taiwan, what is it? Is it a nation? Absolutely not. Has it ever tried to be an independent nation? Absolutely not. Taiwan is an island. The government that operates out of Taipei is the Republic of China, not the Republic of Taiwan, the Republic of China, like the whole thing. So how did that happen? Well, quick history. Taiwan was just a Chinese island. Now, before World War II, most of the people in Taiwan were like pretty ethnically different from the Chinese, but they'd like been part of the Chinese Empire for quite some time. Not always, but that's the case of much of China. But, you know, for a long time, Taiwan was part of China. Then the Japanese showed up and occupied it. It was awful. Then the Japanese left. Then the Chinese had a civil war between the communists and the nationalists, actually the second civil war. The nationalists did basically the worst job fighting that war that they could possibly do, and they lost. They retreated to Taiwan, where they had just enough water between them and the communists to hold out. And that government, that nationalist government, became a government in exile, right? The Republic of China. And so their official claim was, is, and always has been that they are the legitimate government of all of China, Taiwan and the mainland together. In Beijing, the communist government claims to be the legitimate government of all of China, Taiwan and the mainland together. And in fact, the Taipei government, the Republic of China, was officially recognized by the United Nations, again set up by the West, until the 1970s as the legitimate government of all of China, until Nixon and Kissinger flipped the tables and got the world to recognize reality that no, the communists are really in charge. If you want to deal with China, you need to deal with Beijing. So again, Taiwan, not an independent country, has never tried to be. Now, do some people in Taiwan want to be an independent nation? And the answer is yes, definitely some do. There is an independence movement in Taiwan. And one of the reasons that Taiwan is a fairly free and prosperous society and China is a semi-totalitarian dictatorship, and generally people who live in free societies aren't interested in being taken over by a semi-totalitarian dictatorship. Great. So an independence party gained popularity in the 1990s and 2000s, bolstered by Clinton sending two aircraft carriers to the Straits of Taiwan when China was rattling sabers about Taiwan and taking it back. But that movement has actually since lost a fair amount of popularity. And right now, the government of Taiwan generally tends towards the idea of maintaining the status quo as long as possible, which is, you know, this kind of ambiguous state where we're like, yeah, we're totally the government of all of China, and having warm, in particular, trade relations with the mainland so that trade flourishes and they're not kind of like blockaded by their biggest trading partner, the mainland. And so when someone says Taiwan is a part of China, basically they're spot on. As we discuss some other territories such as Tibet, actually a very different story, very different people, a lot more desire for independence there, but they sorely lack the means to make it happen. Taiwan, if it really wanted to become independent, would have a few paths. Actually, one, it would be, hey, United States, if China attacked us, would you defend us? I actually wrote a paper on this and I can link it. Other interesting trivia that comes from that. So the reason why so many Chinatowns in the United States speak primarily Cantonese rather than Mandarin and have a particular kind of like food is that the people who got to escape the onslaught of the communists were the people who lived in Guangdong. So Guangdong is where Cantonese comes from. And so their food and culture and language was the one that like left China in exile in droves in the 60s or in the 50s and 60s, and a lot of them came to the United States. So Guangdong culture is here, and that's why you don't find General Tso's chicken in Beijing, because it's a Guangdong kind of food. So there you go.
I actually didn't know that. Interesting.
Now you do.
See, even I learn new things from our podcast, Eric.
In the middle of the show.
In the middle of the show. It's great. So the next thing that's worth talking about is Chinese-North Korean relations. And the common narrative here is China is an ally of North Korea. And this is kind of true. Kind of. It is, to really understand, or rather to evaluate this claim and this narrative in greater detail, we need to think about the geography of the North Korean-Chinese border a little bit. Now, historically, unified Korea, before it was split into two countries following World War II, has generally been antagonistic of China, because once unified, the entire Korean Peninsula is able to draw on far greater resources and manpower in a way that is threatening to China.
And in fact, the Koreans kicked the Chinese butts in a few wars when China kept going like, "Ooh, Korea, you should be part of China." The Koreans were like, "No, whack," a couple times. It has not worked out well for the Chinese.
Now, today, China benefits from a North Korean state as a buffer state because the U.S., as Eric mentioned, has troops in South Korea. It's about 37,000, unless they've reduced troop levels recently. But it's tens of thousands. There are talks to decrease them, but it hasn't really happened yet. And this is a result of the Korean War in the early 50s. And the reason that China got involved in the Korean War was because the U.S. was doing too good. And they pushed far north, crossed the Yalu River, and the Chinese were like, "Nah, we know you say you're just going to war with North Korea, but it seems like you're pretty close to our southern borders. So whack," which is apparently what counteroffensive and war sound like on the Reconsider podcast. Whack.
And China delivered the United States its worst land defeat in history by sneaking down through the mountains and then flooding out along to the sea where the United States troops were like stretched out. It was awful. It was a butchering.
Right. And those troops, not those troops, but the U.S. still has troops in South Korea because the Korean War never ended technically. There's an armistice, which they stopped shooting at each other. So China wants that buffer space with at least a friendly country between it and U.S. forces in South Korea and South Korea itself. Now, China doesn't control North Korea. And I think the way that a lot of news is written makes it seem like that is the case. China certainly has some influence on North Korea, in large part because North Korea receives a lot of its oil from China, and that's sort of a critical lifeline in order to sustain its military, right? If North Korea could no longer get oil, then like all of its defense calculations would go out the window because it couldn't defend itself. So China has influence over North Korea, but it really doesn't control. Xi does not control Kim Jong-un, and that is something that we've seen throughout the ordeal, especially in the middle and early parts of last year, when President Trump would basically go to Xi and say, "Okay, well, you know, go get some concessions from North Korea and we'll give you some concessions." And like, usually nothing really happened. And that's because North Korea is a different state and Kim Jong-un and the North Korean regime has different security interests than do China. China also doesn't want North Korea to collapse, though. So in that sense, the North Korean regime and China do have interests that align. This is the case because if North Korea were to collapse, it would result in really massive refugee flows northward, as well as probably, again, U.S. and South Korean occupation of North Korea in order to try to stabilize the situation, which China doesn't want. And that is in part why China keeps providing lifelines to North Korea. It doesn't want sanctions to bite as hard as the West does.
Yeah, you know that saying, we're full of sayings today, but you know that saying, holding a wolf by the ears? Like, what do you do when you hold a wolf by the ears? You keep holding on, right? And so to some extent, China is stuck with North Korea because it, no matter how irritating, well, not no matter, but like to a large extent, no matter how irritating North Korea gets, China can't just go like, all right, forget it. You're on your own. You wither and die on me, because it would be absolute disaster for China.
Absolute. So anyways, on this particular narrative, I think we can walk away with sort of a couple of helpful perspectives to frame the issue. One of which is, in the short run, China and North Korea definitely do have some interests that align. They both want North Korea to stick around for a while and for the North Korean regime to remain intact, not to collapse, and to keep U.S. troops out of North Korea. In the long run, though, and this is definitely getting into a bit more speculation, but given the trends of history, we can still say a couple of informed things about it, which is China doesn't really want a unified Korea again on its southern border. And in the long run, the North has repeatedly said, basically since the 1950s, that its goal is to reunify the peninsula. Of course, that would be under a regime led by the North. So in some sense, North Korea ultimately wants a unified peninsula and China does not. So here is an example of how two countries can have interests that work out in the short run, but not the long run. And that's just an interesting thing to think about. Generally, whenever you're looking at international news, think about how and why countries are working together right now and whether those are deep, long-term alignments of interests or whether things can change.
All right.
Reconsider.
Oh, yeah. So, next misconception. China has set up a fairly dystopian system in which your rights as a citizen depend on the government's perception of your loyalty to the state. So, this one isn't true because, this one is actually super duper true, and it's pretty messed up. And it's especially true in the non-Han parts of China, such as Xinjiang, which is that Uyghur Northwest area. So, you know, like the stories coming out of that place are often pretty scary. Chinese security agents will follow Uyghurs who leave the country, sometimes hold their families hostage, and force expats to basically act as information collectors for them. And for everyone else that's not part of this like kind of brutally suppressed area, there is a social credit system. So here in capitalist America, you have credit score, and it's based on, you know, what's your history been of repaying your debts, and therefore how easy is it for you to get money at a good rate in the future, because hopefully past behavior is a predictor of future behavior. In China, there's a social credit system, and Xi has helped put it in place. And basically, if you screw up, it gets in the way of your ability to do anything that you would need to do. So, for example, if you have a low social credit score, you cannot get on a plane or a train. You get your internet cut off. Your kids cannot go to good schools. You are not allowed to get certain jobs. You cannot stay at certain hotels. You get publicly shamed by the government. Alternatively, there is a carrot to this. If you have good credit scores, you get those better jobs. And you even get if you're on a dating site in China, or certain dating sites in China, your profile gets boosted if you have a good social credit score, making it easier for you to find that love of your life. So keep the government happy, and they will, one, not ruin your life, and two, might even help you out a little bit. And how do you gain or lose credit? It's actually kind of a mystery. So that has always confused me. It's sort of like the Dr. Strangelove quote, like, why would you have a doomsday deterrent device if you're not going to tell anyone? Right. So like, how do you like effectively control people's behavior if you don't tell them what behaviors get them the nice things and the terrible things from the government? But there are some public examples. If you bad driving, smoking where you're not allowed to smoke, buying too many video games, posting what the government considers, quote, fake news, which, you know, given how fake news is thrown around, is pretty much just criticizing the government generally or not towing the line, right? But, you know, as a whole, this exact methodology is a secret. But yes, what's going on in China right now is the government has decided that it's going to track your every behavior and it's going to adjust your rights, I mean privileges, accordingly, based on how good a citizen you're being. Isn't that nice?
It is nice. I promise that I will not post any fake news.
Yes, only good, true news about Xi Jinping and glorious communist government.
It is quite glorious.
Quite glorious. That is a fact.
Yes. Another point, another common narrative is the idea that China is a currency manipulator and therefore cheats in international trade by artificially lowering the value of its currency so it can export more. This is a very in-depth issue that we could probably do a whole episode on this.
We should
do a whole episode on this.
It's a great idea.
But the takeaway is that China has more control over its currency than many other countries, but it still kind of floats, and it kind of sometimes doesn't artificially cheapen its currency. In fact, much of last year, China was trying to bolster the strength of its currency by actually selling treasuries and other U.S. foreign reserves that it had because it was fearful of capital outflows. So China definitely influences the value of its currency. Sometimes it's one way, sometimes it's another, but it's hard to tell, you know, to what degree sometimes, because frankly, the rules for there's this, like this auto adjustment mechanism. I forget the exact word for it that they talk about, but exactly how that works is not publicly available information.
Yeah. And, you know, the United States, whenever it decides to print gob of money, changes its relative currency value to other currencies. This is not to necessarily say that China always plays by the rules certainly according to like the WTO that it's part of, or that it is a lover of unrestricted free trade or anything like that, or that it doesn't try to like make the system work to its advantage. But holy smokes, is it complicated. And, you know, China to some extent seems to understand that it needs to play within the rules to a certain amount. And, you know, if it just tried to go totally off the rails, it would not work out really well for it. So let's do an episode on China and international trade, because it's a cool topic that, you know, I'm far enough out of touch with over the past few years that I need to do a bunch of research before I can even like share facts about what's going on. So stay tuned for a great episode on China and international trade.
Yeah, there's also the whole issue of China's financial system generally, how that relates to the performance of its broader economy, and in one case, particular real estate. And we, again, could probably do, and maybe we should do a whole episode on this, but understanding the degree of China's overall power really requires understanding what is relative fragility in its economy and financial system. And this is something that the Communist Party is actively working on. But basically, one of the ways that China funded a lot of its growth was with debt, government spending, and a lot of this money flowed to new construction, so building new property. And a lot of this property ended up being vacant. And anyways, the point is China now needs to move away from this model of growth where they're just constantly building stuff and gradually build their private consumption base, their consumer base. And this is a difficult thing to do at all. One, because you have to strike a balance without throwing the real estate market into a spiral, which can bring much of the entire system with it. And it needs to do this while it is getting into a trade war right now with the US. So that's for another show, but also important.
Ooh, this is going to be a really fun series, I think. So, you know, the big question is, how do we better understand China? And you may ask, why do I need to understand China? That's what the folks in, you know, DC or London or wherever, you know, my capital are for. But hey, guess what? If 2016 tells you anything, it's that your vote matters. So we want to help you understand, you know, the second big largest economy, second largest population in the world, growing power, all that important stuff. We want to help you understand it as well as you can, and help you have the context to be skeptical about the claims that, you know, media and politicians tend to make. You've heard me go on this before, but just one of the things to keep in mind about China is that China is very old, like very, very old. And it has a conception of itself as very, very old in a way that a lot of places don't. You know, so for example, Germany, the United States, like, don't think of ourselves as that old. In Germany, people lived there for much longer, but Germany as a concept is, 1800s kind of concept. And China is a 5,000-year-old concept. And Chinese people are taught their history probably with the same loving attention that the Texans have learned theirs, except there's, you know, 100 times as much of it. And that actually, as far as I can tell, really actually influences how Chinese people think about themselves, their country, their relationship with the world, and seems to influence Chinese policymaking and behavior as a nation on the world stage quite a bit. So to that end, I want to make a second plug again for Chris Stewart's History of China, and we're going to try to twist his arm to get him in on our next episode to help us understand a little bit of that, you know, a tiny, tiny sliver of that history as context for understanding how China has acted through the 20th and into the 21st century and why, and maybe even understand from an historical perspective how China is facing its current challenges in the world with the United States and its neighbors and all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah. And so with that, we'd like to remind everyone, as always, don't let the pundits do the thinking for you. Pause and reconsider. This is Xander signing off.
And this is Eric signing off. Zaijian.
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way. Because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.